Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, hands-on with the Leap Motion controller, Samsung's 840 Evo, an awesome and affordable SSD. How about the new Nexus 7 and that $35 Chromecast from Google, V8 CPU cooler, viewer questions, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 227, recorded July 25th, 2013. Leap Motion, Samsung 840 Evo, and Chromecast. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWITCH. And by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show on Twitch where we aim to bring you the best, the most useful, the most exciting, and the most practical advice on PCs, tablets, and pretty much anything else you can run a program on. Mr. Ryan Shrout is off in golf land, someplace where the internet doesn't work too well, possibly in the South, not slight in the South, or its internet capacities. Just saying, Ryan's in a hotel where the internet is broke. So joining me tonight, Mr. Robert Heron from Techzilla and HD Nation. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you, Patrick.
It's exciting. Should we start with you pre-ordered a Leap Motion. The Leap Motion arrived. You want to talk about Leap Motion or should we talk about Chromecast?
I like them both. Just Leap Motion to get it out of the way. That's the motion controller, basically. It's a camera-based device, and it's about the size of a small stick, in essence. And this little thing incorporates a couple of cameras with a couple of infrared LEDs to illuminate the area right above your workspace. And pretty much it's hand tracking at this point. Finger-sized objects or pen-sized objects within its field of view, which is pretty big, actually, about 8 cubic feet. And as you manipulate your hand within that environment, it's able to do super precise tracking of the individual digits, or if you're using just your single finger, for anything, really. And that's where the software kind of kicks in. They just launched their new store for downloading apps, in addition to probably my favorite app right now, though, has to be just messing around with Google Earth and being able, the latest version of Google Earth, if you load it up with this device, there's native support for it built right in, where you can use your hand to literally do a Superman-style fly through the through the universe of Google Earth, which is just spectacular, especially if you're able to do it on a pretty powerful PC that's keeping the graphics at high quality and streaming the data in on a nice internet connection too, because it's easy just to move around the globe and go in and out really quick, so you want the data to stream fairly quick. So it's a good looking experience as well. But for $80, I gotta say, and the quality of the software I'm seeing kicking up on their store, it's looking pretty good. And the thing is that the hardware is pretty fixed. There's really not a lot to do further with the hardware side of it. However, right, the software could always be improved down the road in terms of either the feedback or the performance or the capabilities. So it's still early. I don't think it's for everyone necessarily, but if you're curious about it, $80 isn't a whole lot to really drop. And I think you get a lot of enjoyment.
It's funny. So it sits, you need to have like a foot in front of your monitor, or it goes like your monitor and then your keyboard and then your Leap Motion. Can you show us some of the hand gestures? And we got a great question from Web3272, slightly generic name in the chat room. But they want to know, Robert Heron, can you hand write words with Leap Motion?
You sure
at which
can,
point,
actually.
Caffeine-free Dave says, so you can give your computer the finger when it crashes and it will know. Yes!
But that would be one thing I would say about the positioning of the device itself is that I have a fairly flat desktop and I used to have a keyboard tray underneath the desk. I would like this device a little bit lower so I can have more room for the vertical and horizontal as far as moving my hand around, especially in the vertical. Being able to move your hand up a little higher, like at least a foot and a foot and a half away from it, it can track that accurately up that high. So that's one of the things. I almost want to put it down a little bit lower than the level of my desk or set myself up a little bit higher when I'm using it. That way it gives me just a little bit easier to use in terms of being able to put my hand down close to it and get it up a couple of feet almost above it in order to fully. Maybe that's something that then they could help tweak within the software itself is saying, you know what, I'm only going to use this within, say, a foot range, do all the scaling within that 1 foot area. That's something else I could see them tweaking in the future, because right now it seems like, especially for Google Earth, like if I want to zoom away from the planet, I've got to move my hand at least a foot and a half away from it. And sometimes I'm putting my hand like right in front of my face, and it can get a little convoluted sometimes. So, and then likewise, you want to be careful not to get your hand too close to the device. If you cover it in a sense, one, you can put a smudge on it, which it will actually tell you if it's got a smudge or not on its view. Or if anything's wrong with its view, it tries to help you. And it's like, hey, I think you put a big booger right on the top of the sensor. Could you please clean that off so I can see clearly? But that's just one thing to realize if you are going to use it at a desk environment, is that you might want to move your seat up a little higher, or if you have that keyboard tray, like I was saying, that might be the place to put it.
It's interesting. So there's the Airspace store where you can find new apps. You said you can definitely like write your name on it or draw things. It's funny. It's multi-touch. You can use all of your fingers to manipulate things, right?
Totally. And some of the demo apps that you go through in terms of the setup show you physically. I mean, it shows you how it's tracking your hand in terms of each finger, the orientation of your hand in terms of just how it rotates this way, forward and backward. Likewise, the same movements. I hate to go back to Google Earth again, but in that demo, tilting your hand forward like that gets you to fly forward, fly back, almost like a helicopter in a sense in terms of that kind of motion. That's the basic control setup. And then for games like Cut the Rope, in a sense. That's an easy one where you're pretty much using just a single finger. And swipe mechanisms, as well as one of the demo programs that they have available as well. It's actually that writing where by pushing your finger in, you'll see it glow, in a sense, when it makes contact with the paper. And then when you pull your finger back, it's taking it off the paper. But when it's pushed in, you can go ahead and do the writing, pull your finger back, and it then stops the writing process. You can move your finger to a different spot on the virtual canvas, so to speak. And those demos work really well. And also the performance of the imager itself. They were claiming, I believe, about 290 frames a second that they're capturing. So that's fairly high speed in terms of grabbing imagery. And it translates into very low latency, I've noticed. So you'll notice also if you go on to the store they have, is that a lot of the programs many of the programs are actually music related in terms of timing and just precision. And it just shows that the capability of the device to do very precise tracking is there. And I'll be curious to see what other types of apps people come up for it. Also, there's plugins too for Windows 7 and 8. So if you want to get your desktop manipulation on, do that as well. So
much more practical than a touchscreen monitor. It's funny. I think my favorite app so far, because I'm looking around airspace.leapmotion.com, which is the applications that work with Airspace, with Leap Motion. The frog dissection, all the glory, none of the guts, geometric photo effects, plugins for Autodesk Maya 2014, Corel's Painter Freestyle. It's an interesting collection of apps because there's music apps, there's seriously high-end creative apps. It's an interesting collection of, you know, of apps across Windows and Apple and education and music. A lot of music apps, it actually seems to be. But it's going to be fun to watch this one evolve. So far, generally much more happy. The user, people who have bought this seem to be much more happy than the Oculus Rift early adopters community.
I think a lot of that too has to be with the price. You're not talking about something that's far more affordable. It's not like I dropped $800 right on this product and then I'm like, wow, you know, for $800, I might be wondering what the hell I just did with my money. But for $80, it's something I want to keep sticking. And it's going to stay on my desk for quite a while. And it'll be interesting to see what further software developments come with it, especially in terms of being able to fine-tune the experience for individuals in their given space. That's something that the Xbox Kinect has sort of an ability to do at this point in terms of how it looks at the environment you're going to be using it in and tries to optimize itself for that. I'll be curious to see if they actually add anything like that to their own setup and use for that as well. But like I said, as those videos are pointing out, the performance is the latency on it in terms of when you make a motion and when it reacts on the screen is very close to what you're seeing right there. Very interesting. And like I said, probably my favorite thing, though, I have to try the dual finger zoom there for that. But the Google Earth support is awesome. And I have to say, that's one of my favorite things to do with it right now is just to really, really enjoy exploring with that program using that interface with the Leap Motion.
And a lot less expensive than buying a new flat panel if you want to interact with your operating system. Even less expensive than the Leap Motion is the Chromecast. Google announced yesterday the man, the myth, the redheaded legend himself, OMG Chad, actually has a full review. He's got one hands-on. We're putting our review up on TechZilla and out on YouTube on Monday. So the Chromecast, if you haven't seen, it's like a 3-inch dongle running the Chrome operating system. It's powered off of, basically, you need to plug a USB power supply into it. It's HDMI. It is one of the dongles we've seen. It is basically, I think, Google's response to the incredible lack of success they had with Google TV. It's pretty interesting. Originally, they were offering 3 free months of Netflix, even if you already were a Netflix subscriber. So you were getting like the $35 dongle plus or minus 3 months of Netflix equals $11. They've since basically filled in their limited number of pre-orders on Netflix that's gone away. But it's a really interesting idea. Netflix, YouTube, Google Play, Chrome. Notice, obviously, no sign of iTunes or Amazon Prime. You know, but it does have Netflix along with Google Play, which I thought was interesting. No remote. It's working with iPhones, iPad, Chrome for Windows, Chrome for Mac. So the idea that basically you use your Android smartphone or your iOS smartphone to control it instead of actually paying for a remote control. And the best thing I saw was essentially, I guess the directions on the box were plug it in, switch input, set it up, and that's it.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I like the idea of using it with my smartphone as well, just being able to control it that way. Now, is that going to be just the receiver itself? Do you think it has basically, is it an Android computer in a sense, just being plugged into your TV, or is it something a little more pared down than that?
What's the real difference between an Android computer and a Chrome computer?
That's a good question.
Yeah. My understanding, though, is that it is running Chrome. So, here it is. HDMI, CEC compatible, 1080p output, 34 grams, 2.4 gigahertz, 802.11 B, G, and N, USB power adapters included. Works with Android 2.3 and higher, iOS 6 and higher, Windows 7 and higher, Mac OS 10.7 and higher, the Chrome OS devices. My understanding is it's running the Chrome operating system, and of course, I can never find the page I want on Google's website.
It's a Wi-Fi device,
though,
so
yeah, it's not supposed to replace like an Ouya as a gaming device,
right?
You know, with Chromecast, you can easily enjoy your favorite online entertainment, movies, TV shows, music, and more from Netflix, YouTube, Google Play, and Chrome. There's nothing basically. They're not making any mention at this point of any type of gaming capability. And the processor on it is not particularly, you know, it's not something I would look at and be thinking about for games. I remember the processor sounding a little modest. I thought it was interesting. Anything that gets more people watching video online, I got a big thumbs up for.
Totally. And it's obvious integration too with the Chrome web browser as well. So that anything you're using on there likely will hopefully be able to stream quite easily to that device. And that'll just help bring. And at the price point too, $35, like somebody mentioned in the chat room, it is an impulse buy on that for a lot of folks. So, and getting a wireless connection from that content on your computer or your smart device to your TV, I think it just further leverages the things you already own and helps you get a little bit more out of them as well. And that price point, though, I think it's just like, okay, that's worth trying. And hopefully it'll continue to mature into a really cool product. I can't wait to get one in my hands, actually.
Neither can I. I wish to take a moment to mention the Samsung 840 Evo. There's a 500 gigabyte and a 1 terabyte. Alan Melventano over at PC Per did the write-up on that. And I'm going to use the man's words. It's an update to the 840 lineup. The new 840 Evo employs Samsung's MEX controller, where the 840 and 840 Pro used MDX and the 830 series used MCX. It's an interesting device. Like Samsung 840 right now, Alan's kind of go-to for affordable SSDs. And he was actually flown out, I believe, to Korea to get hands-on and get the review on, or basically get the announcement on this one. And really the big deal, you start looking at it, is the idea is that the 840 Evo is doing some pretty serious sequential write speeds. They're claiming on the 120 gigabyte version, 410 megabytes per second, 520 on the 250 gigabyte, and excuse me, and 520 on the 500, 750 gigabyte, and 1 terabyte versions. But they're using all TLC flash on a smaller process. And they did that using something called TurboWrite technology. So they basically put part of the TLC flash becomes a buffer, like 12 gigabytes of flash on the drive are being used as a buffer, what they call a, quote, simulated SLC. So first you write to the buffer, and then you transfer to the rest of the SSD in the background, which is kind of the whole point of a buffer, right? Benchmarks look good. The conclusion I thought was really interesting. Pros, outstanding performance, highly competitive cost per gigabyte. Cons, TurboWrite cache may get overloaded in some corner case heavy demand scenarios, i.e. writing gigantic file after gigantic file. The pricing looks really, really good, $110. We saw this slide last week, but you're looking at $110 for a 120 gigabyte version, $125 if you buy the full desktop kit would be like an adapter and maybe transfer software. 1 terabyte for $650, 750 gigabytes for $529.99. And Alan says, he really hopes these prices stick. Looking at like a three-year warranty. The 840 Pro is the 5-year warranty. Quote, using some of the spare TLC area as an SLC write cache is a brilliant idea that was executed beautifully by Samsung. The TurboCache enabled the Evo to achieve long burst write speeds exceeding that of other TLC drives and even some MLC ones. While the cache space is limited, it is sufficient in size to cover most, if not all, consumer workload scenarios. That's really good, and they gave it an editor's choice. It's interesting. Alan's really curious if the pricing holds because, quote, I have yet to see sub $1 per gigabyte pricing hold, unquote. But he basically says if that pricing sticks, if it hits the marketplace and stays at that pricing, this is going to be the best deal in terms of cost versus performance versus capacity for an SSD drive. So I like the idea of SSD drives getting less expensive.
And I'll take that 500 gig unit for my next computer build. That'll be the primary boot drive. Or bigger, I'll go with a bigger drive if possible.
I mean, it's a big drop compared to what we were seeing, this time last year. And I'm really curious if those prices hold and they start to drop towards the holiday shopping season, it's going to be time for everyone to get an SSD drive. Everyone.
But the largest end, 64 cents a gig for the largest model at least. Yeah. And that's when it gets down into the 50 cents a gig for most folks, and that can't be too far off, I think. Hopefully before year's end, we'll see somebody hit that, maybe on one of the value deals of the day or whatever. But that's just something I think will finally help push SSDs into more computers out there right now. Because for the last couple of years, that's been my favorite piece of technology in the PC space in terms of outright performance, more so than any of the latest chip announcements. Although graphics cards, I seem to buy a new one just about on average about every year. But the SSD technology, without a doubt, is the thing that's changed more for me in the last couple of years as far as my compute experience and using computers and both portable and my workstation. And it's just such a game changer across the board for just usability and your own time savings. It's just something I really have come to just, I couldn't live without at this point. So it's good to see the prices coming down.
It is. Hey, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, one of our two sponsors for this episode of Twitch, ProXPN. If you haven't heard about it, you should. We got a 20% off deal for you. ProXPN is a global VPN, a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection, creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all your online data passes back and forth. If you've ever been in a hotel like Ryan and worried about the security of your data, that's where a VPN gets really seriously useful. Or if you have two offices, Office A, Office B, you want them to communicate, say, sensitive financial data or files. Let me tell you something, a VPN will save you. ProXPN, basically any online app can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguises your physical location, and gives you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So maybe you're in the office and maybe you don't want them to know you're streaming music. Not that I'd ever suggest you do this. You could use a VPN like ProXPN, if they let you use it in the office, to access your websites without sharing that information to everybody in the office. Or like if you travel, and just about everybody does at some point or another, it's a great way to make the hotel Wi-Fi safer. This is going to block ISP spying. It's going to block scary people on the hotel network. It's going to allow you to securely transfer data if you're worried about, you know, if you're in a client's office or something. VPNs are really, really good. 512-bit encryption works via OpenVPN or PPTP, and you get to choose that. It's pretty cool. You know, you can keep your personal internet usage private at work, and you can keep it safe on the road. And that's why I like VPNs. You know, you can, if there's internet filtering where you're located, you can bypass that. You can bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video. They have servers in the US, the UK, Asia, and more. For example, if I wanted to watch something that wasn't available in the United States, like curling videos, I could do it. Or if you're overseas and want to watch a service that's only available in the US, you could use ProXPN to do that. Basically makes your internet connection region free, which could be helpful, say, if you want to be able to watch videos that aren't currently available in your region. Software for Windows and Mac allows you to select the programs and ports you want to I like the 512-bit security shield you're seeing on the screen right now. Essentially, you get to select the programs and the ports that you want to route through ProXPN servers. Keep them anonymous wherever you go. Works with iOS and Android devices. Great customer support. Steve Gibson gave it a great review on Security Now, and we would like you to try it out and help support Twitch. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $75 for the entire year. We've got a special offer. If you use the code Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, you will receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That is a huge discount, 20% off. That means you would be paying less than $5 a month on the weekly, $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code Twitch. proxpn.com/twit. Twitch is the code. You get a 20% discount. And we want to thank ProXPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And I'll say it one more time, proxpn.com/twit, and use the code Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, for a 20% discount. Thank you, ProXPN. do you ever want all the eye candy, Mr. Robert Heron?
Always. Well,
always.
At least the shiniest pixels. That's all I
did
want.
Did you see the Extreme Windows blog pushing the 12K PC gaming boundary at 1.5 billion pixels per second?
That's needed, depending on how many displays you're currently driving. You know, there are a lot of people out there doing multi-display gaming where they're piling the output across multiple displays for very high resolutions, even above 4K in some cases, like that person right there.
Yes. So
when you're running.
So I don't know if you saw it. So Sharp actually sampled three of the 32-inch 4K monitors to Microsoft's Extreme Windows. So if you like blog.microsoft.com, blog.windows.com/windows/B/Extreme Windows, just look for a link in the show notes. But essentially, it's Sharp's PNK32-1 4K Ultra HD displays. It is crazy.
We previewed those at CES, and those are amazing-looking monitors. I mean, they're just the detail you get on at 32 inches and having that many pixels on screen. It's not quite, you know, retina display quality, but it's pretty close. Right. And then chaining three of those together in a 3x1 configuration, that's just fun. And if you have the horsepower to do it, and I guess that AMD graphics card with its Eyefinity technology can handle it, apparently. That's got to be good. Although I noticed the aspect ratio they're showing on those monitors in that one picture was a little messed up, but still.
I think that's glare from the flash they were using because
it's like either the aspect ratio is wrong on the video or something because it's not quite filling the whole monitor up on that.
Oh, I think it's because of that.
There you go. Well,
yeah, it's kind of funny because it's $15,000 worth of monitors, and I'm looking at the story here. So DirectX 11, 30 hertz, obviously the monitor that the 4K desktop monitor Ryan was talking about last week, running at 60K but using a radically different 60 hertz but running a radically different connection. So AMD brings over an Asus HD 7970 DirectCU2 card with four full-size DisplayPort outputs. And so when they set up, if you scroll down to the control panel, it's awesome. When you look at change the appearance of your display, 1150 11,520 by 2,160 duplicating desktop on one and two. That is one giant wide display. So that's the equivalent of 12 1080p displays, 24,883,200 pixels.
So nice. Yeah. In order to get that high of density as far as pixel resolution goes on a monitor, that was incorporating one of the technologies that Sharp showed off as well at the show called IGZO that allowed not only basically more light to be transmitted through, but the panel is actually more efficient electrically. And it had a number of benefits. Also looking forward to touch devices or touch screen devices as well down the road. But it required some extra engineering in order to be able to pull off that density without it. To have it work even. And so hopefully we'll see more displays like that from other manufacturers as well. But Sharp's kind of got a cool piece of tech in their hands at the moment in terms of being able to create these super high density displays at small screen sizes, be it 32 inch in that case, but even down further into handheld sizes as well. We should be seeing some hopefully whatever the next gen bit of tablets and other handheld devices are offering even higher resolutions than we're seeing today.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's funny the summary that PC Per wrote. Where is it? If I had a brain, it'd be useful. Sorry.
You've got a brain.
3 3840 by 2160 monitors to a 3x1 Infinity configuration at 60 hertz, 7 feet diagonally. This configuration, unlike the already supported 3-display 30 hertz and single display 60 hertz 4K models, required AMD to develop a customized driver.
Those are good problems to have, though.
Yeah,
it's like, hey, we got crazy pixel count here. What are we gonna do? We need a new driver. Well, get the driver guys working on that.
So Scott Michaud wrote the executive summary up on PCPer.com. There's also a great picture there about basically needing, I think, two power supplies to power this giant collection of cards, this giant card in there. Quote, lastly, I need to call out drama as I see it. Power supplies. It is not hard to find a PSU which can support a 3-GPU system and no reason for it to be hanging outside the case. It might give off the bleeding edge appearance, but this is not arc welding. I was laughing. Basically, they made it look like they needed all the power in the planet because there was a power supply hanging outside of the case for the demo. So apparently this is, you know, the usage scenario for 1500 watt power supplies, and man, Dirt 2 is looking really good. I get excited. NVIDIA Shield begins shipping July 31st, $299 MSRP. Are you excited? Do you care? I was profoundly confused watching this at CES.
For which thing?
The NVIDIA Shield.
I've got my phone. I'm not into portable handheld gaming ever since I gave up my 3D for good old, from Nintendo. So I could go for a new handheld gaming system if it has the proper support. And that's going to be a full Android unit, right, with the Tegra graphic system. And, man, it's got all the right pieces.
Tim Barry writes, integrated 5-inch 720 touchscreen display that hinges clamshell style from the back of the controller. Android Jelly Bean and can play Android games as well as traditional PC games that are streamed from PCs with a qualifying NVIDIA graphics card. Yeah, it's like a Tegra 4 system on a chip, so you can play Android games or you can run games on your PC, basically stream the graphics to your device. It was supposed to ship in June, but there was an unspecified problem or a problem with a mechanical device that was from an unspecified manufacturer. Got pushed out. They dropped $50 off the price. So they're already down to $299 from the original price of $350. I'm kind of curious. I'm also kind of curious about the Shield Experience Centers, which will be at, quote, certain GameStop, Micro Center, and Canada Computer Shops in the U.S. and Canada. I don't hear a lot of excitement about this, and I thought there would at least be some.
It's also Android game development as well. It doesn't seem focused on super high resolution games or games that require a lot of 3D eye candy. Maybe I'm wrong on a few titles, I'm sure, but most games I see are almost like Flash-based games in terms of the look of them. Now, I'm sure there are a few out there that go beyond that, but we need to see more games that actually require heavy-duty hardware and then the developers taking advantage of that If that's the case, then man, something like that would be quite popular, especially if it's if I could leverage the purchases I've already made within my current Android wallet as far as, hey, you've got all these other titles here, and here's a more powerful gaming experience you can have on something that's pretty affordable, at least cheaper than, you know, most cell phones out there, or most new smartphones nowadays. So that would be one thing it encourages me to at least try it out.
I like Web4075 in the chat room. The new Nexus 7 will trump it. Cold, but probably true. New Nexus 7 shipping July 30th, $229 for the 16-gigabyte version, $269 for the 32-gigabyte Wi-Fi. These are basically the Wi-Fi versions. Start at $229, top out at $269 for the 32-gigabyte version. This is not particularly surprising. The Nexus 7 has been sold out for weeks. Most of the other major Android vendors like Barnes & Noble and Amazon have started dropping, if not outright dumping, their tablet stocks. A 1900 by 1200 panel, that's a honking jump over the 1280 by 800 display off of the Nexus 7 that came out last year. 1.5 gigahertz Qualcomm Snapdragon S4 Pro 8064 processor. But wait, because not only do you get four cores of glory. Wait, is it quad core? No, it's not. Is it quad
core? I'm having glory.
I can't remember. It's late and I've been in meetings. And the Adreno 320 graphics, 2 gigabytes of RAM, Android 4.3 Jelly Bean. The coolest thing for me is it's a Nexus, so it's unlocked. $349 for the LTE model. AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon compatible out of the box. You know, and it, I was saying yesterday on Tuxilla, supposedly the rumor is, and the part of the reason I say that is because, you know, sometimes you hear things and the product manager believes it and the press release says it and it still doesn't happen. And for some reason, I'm just still amazed that AT&T is finally going to do an unlocked device, which I thought, you know, I'm a little exciting. I'm a little easily excitable, but I'm actually excited to see this tablet because it looks like it's going to be honking fast. And $229 is cheap.
That's a great price. See, too, when you're talking about the Shield versus, you know, what else, and I keep thinking, too, what will be my next smartphone device? And it's like, well, am I gonna double up on my hardware and have two devices to carry around, or am I going to be really focused on whatever my next smartphone will be and ensuring it has probably twice the effective compute power as my current smartphone. So those kind of leaps too are we're right in the middle of all of that. So it's the other kind of like makes me stop and go, in terms of do I really want another portable handheld unit, at least one specific to gaming only for myself. And I could see though, if as a gift though, it might be really good though, especially if you're looking for something that's not a smartphone for a young person, right, where you really want them just to stay out of that realm and stick more to the app experience and the game experience itself. That could be pretty cool. But I'm immediately thinking, hey, can't I already connect my Bluetooth PS3 controller to my Galaxy S3? And I'm like, I'm close, but you know, the Shield though has at least 2x the graphics horsepower compared to my phone, and like the S4 out now, it also has about 2x the compute power compared to the S3 did. So it's we're in that golden age of just watching these mobile devices just jump up in terms of power and and capability.
It's funny. It's like a 5-megapixel rear-facing camera. You know, you're looking at OpenGL ES 3.0 support, which is something that's a big deal for game developers. Let's see. Radio Shack, Walmart, Amazon, and, of course, Best Buy as of July 30th. Other countries, including the UK, Germany, Japan, Canada, Spain, France, Australia, and South Korea, will get the tablet in the coming weeks. We don't know when the LTE versions will be available. The Wi-Fi version is going to be coming out first. NFC is on board, so you can get your Google Wallet on and start touching things, which always sounds a little creepy when you say it like that. That screen's going to – I think that screen's going to be gorgeous, 1920 by 1200. I'm exciting.
That is. And for its size and the cost – that's like the tablet I would hand a very young child and go, okay, I'm not going to scream if it, you know, if it gets hammered into the wall a couple of times, but
you'll scream a little bit.
Yeah.
Or at least you'll stare blankly in horror. Small child, that was useful until you slammed it against the wall over and over.
Is it drool proof?
One more. Nothing is drool proof unless it's in a waterproof case. Ask me how I know. NVIDIA introduces Kepler, Ultramobile, Market, and Tegra. Josh wrote this up at PCPer.com, and I'm going to read straight from his summary. What Kepler really brings to the table is a part that is fully compliant with all the latest industry standards, not just OpenGL ES 3.0, but OpenGL 4.4, CUDA 5.0 compliant, which is a massive jump from the non-compliancy of previous Tegra parts. It's also DX11 compliant, which is more than not a boon for Microsoft and their Windows RT platform, as much as Windows RT exists after the depressing sales of RT tablets in the last quarter. As such, it fully implements a strong tessellation engine. From my understanding, the latest generation computing units do not support this feature. This is a big deal. You know, for you know, the kind of subtitle that Josh put on this, or Scott, I'm not sure who put it on there, but thank you. NVIDIA finally gets serious with Tegra. Tegra 1 was in a Zune. Tegra 2 shipped late and nearly killed off a couple of products in the process. Tegra 3 ended up in the Surface, which, quote, has turned out to be a far more bitter experience than expected. In case you missed Twitch last week, we talked about basically the death of Windows RT as Microsoft wrote off $900 million in inventory. I've heard something like 90% of the Windows RT tablets just never were sold, which is pretty brutal. But basically what NVIDIA is doing is finally bringing their superior graphics expertise into an ARM part. And if it ships in a timely fashion and it delivers, you know, 192 CUDA cores in that little tiny package, that could be really serious for mobile gaming and mobile fun. So, and I should also point out the Snapdragon S4 Pro is a 4-core processor, the one in the new Nexus 7. So I'm not completely on crack.
Not at all. Not at all. That is an interesting looking part, I have to say. It's one of the just the power that's available now for mobile units, and to be able to pair that with something like ARM processing, which, if anything, ARM really does need a good graphics part to go with it. It doesn't matter which chip you're talking about as far as the design goes there. It's having that horsepower is just is the kick in the pants it really needed.
There you have it. We should take a moment to thank our sponsor, Ting. I'm a Ting customer two times over. I actually ported over a smartphone to Ting that had originally been on Sprint. Duh. Ting is a Sprint and MNVO, a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network, and they aim to be a no BS network. I think you know what BS means. And if you're under 18, ask your parents, and they'll slap you, and then you can slap me. But we want to thank Ting for supporting the show. I really like Ting. I use it for my, been using it a lot for several months for my portable modem. Radically dropped the amount of money I was spending. I don't use a modem for like 10 gigabytes a month. I use it for a few days here, then I don't use it for a few weeks. I use it for a couple of days there. Maybe I'll use it when I'm commuting. But I used to pay like $60 a month to have, you know, my 4G LTE modem. And suddenly I'm paying $6 a month for the device plus $3 a month for the service. Now, if I download a whole bunch of data, I pay a little bit more. It's really, really cool the way that Ting does this. So if you're not familiar with Ting, the big difference between Ting and Sprint or Ting and most other carriers is that you buy your hardware, right? So rather than them making lots and lots of money off a two-year contract of you, they make a modest amount of money, a reasonable amount of money every month. You own your hardware, so you can leave at any time. There's no permanent contracts. There's no getting slapped with quitting fees, no early termination fees. So, you know, what I do is I choose like extra small. And then if I use more data, they just bump me up to the next level. And it's really, really simple. You may find out they have a great chart that allows you to look at your current contract pricing versus what the amount of minutes and data and text messages you use would actually cost you on Ting. You know, if my wife and I moved off of our current iPhone contract and onto Ting, we wouldn't be able to use the iPhone currently, but we could move to Ting on other delightful devices. We might save like $2,000 a year on the phone bill. That is a lot of money. No overage charges or penalties. If you use more data than you have selected in your plan, they just bump you up to the next level. There's no punitive charges. There's no outrageous fees at the end of the month. There's no weird like, hey, you're going to pay $4 a month to get voicemail. Unlimited devices on one plan. They have a great website and control panel that allows you to configure things, set things up, keep track of what's going on. The customer support is great. 1-855-TING-FTW. Or you can contact them via email. I talked to them on the phone when I was looking to move a device over. They not only had answers for me, but then they summarized our conversation and made sure I had the information I needed linked in an email that they sent to me afterwards. Help.ting.com, their online support is excellent, and they are looking to help you. I find it refreshing, right? I'm a customer. I pay out of my own pocket for the device and the service, and I'm really happy I did it because I have the mobile connectivity I wanted, and I'm paying a lot less money for it, and I don't feel like I've been beaten with a stick every time I talk to customer service. It's really, really cool. I'd like you to check it out. I'd like you to offer a deal on it. It's Twitch, TWICH.ting.com. And if you sign up with Ting on that site, you will get $25 off on your first Ting device. Twitch.ting.com. Start saving today and do yourself a favor. Check out the savings calculator. See how much you or your company could save. Save money, better manage your mobile life with Ting. And we want to thank Ting for sponsoring this episode of Twitch. Twitch.ting.com. Start saving today, people. Oh my goodness. The ridiculous PC upgrade product of the week is going to the Cooler Master V8 GTS CPU, the massive V8 GTS CPU cooler. The V8 GTS is 154 by 140 by 153.5 millimeters and weighs, brace yourselves, 1.9 pounds. Combines a horizontal vapor chamber, 8 heat pipes, triple aluminum fin stacks, and 2 shrouded PWM fans with red LEDs because, yo, red is pimping inside your PC. Tim Berry wrote it up for PCPer.com. Compatible with both Intel and AMD CPU sockets, LGA 7750, 1150, 1155, 1156, 1366, 2011, AM2, AM3, AM3 Plus, FM1, MF2. And it's kind of funny. So there's a horizontal vapor changer. Say that 3 times fast on the CPU base plate. Basically to suck the heat off the processor and into the heat pipes. 8 6-millimeter heat pipes. And the fans can get loud, I bet, 600 to 1600 RPM. And there's 2 of those puppies, 28 to 82 cubic feet per minute.
Nice.
That is a big.
I'd run that at low speeds and enjoy the cooling performance. You don't have to run it at max power. Although, I wonder if you turn the red lights on or off. That's the only thing I would ask because my case is actually sealed up, so I wouldn't even see the red lights. I guess it doesn't matter, but.
Worst case scenario is you just cut the little wires to them. It's rated to be cool. It says 250 watts. So
excellent. That looks like a good air cooler for overclocking experiments too. So I use something like a Noctua that uses the dual fan design as well for a push pull through the multiple cooling fans, and it's effective the way it works. And you basically run the exhaust straight to the rear of the case where it's going to be output through the back panel. And otherwise, that's a fairly standard design. I don't know, maybe the number of cooling pipes is a couple more than other systems have, but those coolers generally work very well, and the design looks pretty cool. I have to say that for Cooler Master, they got a good looking part there. So
you like the big shiny fans?
I just like good coolers that I can run slow, so I can not hear them when things get hot. And also, if you can keep if it's got a decent design where it's just not a dust magnet either, where it's collecting a bunch of crud inside. But that's, I think, more related to how well your case is filtering air that's coming in than it is for the cooler itself. But what'd they say the price is on that thing? That was the one thing I missed. I didn't even see the price.
That's a really good question.
They generally don't make stuff that's too crazy expensive, so I'm going to think
Cooler Master.
Give me affordability. So I'll say the Noctua I was mentioning. I think I have their 12 model. That's about $80. I paid for that thing back in the day, but it's been flawless for a few years now of continuous use. Well, almost continuous use. And it has kept I have an overclocked i7 part that's been continuously overclocked since I put it together almost 4 years ago now. That cooler just keeps it chilled, which I need.
I have found it on the Amazons.
Awesome.
Cooler Master V8 GTS high performance CPU cooler with horizontal vapor changer and 8 heat pipes by Cooler Master, $83.52 on Prime, temporarily out of stock. But
not
it does
bad.
Look glorious. It's also really funny. Customers who viewed this item also viewed the Cooler Master V8, the Asus Direct CU2 thermal design with direct GPU contact 10 millimeter copper heat pipe, the Cooler Master V6.
How much do you need? I'll be curious to see some reviews that put it side by side against some of the better coolers out there too, especially in that price category.
I mean, we were talking about this on Techzilla like last week, that you start looking at the cooler roundups and there's like $25, $35 coolers that are doing as good a job, you know, within a couple of degrees, even overclocking of coolers that cost twice as much. So Tweaktown has reviews of them. Hardware Secrets, Hardware
Commits. Say the only failure I've had on a cooler in memory was one of the less expensive coolers that the fan just simply stopped running one day.
Right.
And of course, you get the warning immediately. The motherboard starts squealing if it's set up properly. But that's the only thing. And I can't even, who knows, maybe that was just a random occurrence. But I will say some of my more pricey coolers, I've never had fan failures on like that.
I've never had a fan failure on my $30 cooler, but I mean, one thing to point out is that the nice thing about the modern chips is that if the cooling goes away, the chips, you know, like Intel chips, they hit 100 degrees Celsius, they automatically start throttling back the cores and then shutting the chip down. So it's not like the days when you could literally wipe out a chip with heat. So,
I have taken chips to that 100 degrees Celsius mark as well. And I'm rather thankful for the fact that they can throttle themselves down and save me a wad of cash from my mad experiments. And so I appreciate it.
I've got to say, based on the Hardware Secrets review, it is not the worst, but by far not the most impressive cooler.
I'll stick with their 212 cooler. 212 Pro for about $30, $35.
Well, apparently my $25, $35 Thermalright True Spirit is beating it by like 9 degrees.
That's the benchmark, right?
That's the decibel. So it's 9 decibels quieter. Pardon me. it's literally middle of the pack, right? And it's right next to a Corsair 860, which is a water cooler. Sigmatech Nighthawk, Deepcool, Iceblade Pro V2. They are doing a lot of testing. But, you know, the really cool stuff like the Cooler Master Sidon, the Corsair H80i at maximum, they're down around like 32, 36 degrees, while the Cooler Master V8 GTS is at 44 degrees. Interesting stuff.
Makes me want to build a new computer.
Everything wants to make you build a new computer. We got to build $500 gaming computer, and we've got to build a Steam box. That's going to be the fun one.
There you go, man.
One last
news. The big picture mode on Steam is pretty cool if you haven't messed with that. It is just a neat interface. Living room, I may add.
I want to do a Steam appliance that like automatically boots into Steam and puts it on my giant freaking 10-foot screen, my 10-foot projector screen, which, by the way, was inexpensive and less expensive than most 55-inch LCD flat panels. New Intel PCN addresses Nook overheating issues. So the next unit of computing, the little box, the giant hockey puck from Intel, it's looking so interesting as a media streamer or a small desktop device. Product change notification regarding one of its Nook barebones systems. Tim Berry wrote this up at PC Per. Addressing the overheating issues that several hardware review sites encountered when performing large file copies across the network using the built-in Wi-Fi card. Intel has reportedly found a solution by adding a 9.5 millimeter thermal pad to the underside of the top cover. The thermal pad will make contact with the mSATA SSD and facilitate heat transfer from the drive into the metal chassis. So PC Simple. Perspective spotted these problems and other tech size. Basically, the mSATA, the SSD, was getting so hot it was causing system freezes and restarts. So, yeah, it's interesting. The Wi-Fi card would overheat, and that would heat up the PCI, and then all heck would break loose. PCN says the solution works, and system retailers should expect shipments of the upgraded cover or boxes with the upgraded cover to arrive as early as August 1st. And Intel is planning to ship out all of its pre-modification inventory before moving on to shipping updated bare-bone systems. So, yeah, you may want to take advantage, Tim Berry says, of one of the third-party Nook cases that eliminate the cooling issues. That's kind of annoying.
It doesn't sound like a difficult fix, though. So if you are doing a lot of transfers using the Wi-Fi chip built into that part, at least you should be aware of that. And then to know that there is a fix out there. And I guess a third-party case would just simply fix it, but it seems a little extreme. It'd be nice if Intel would just supply that pad for the do-it-yourselfers out there to be able just to mod their own hardware real quick just to get it there. But maybe that's something they don't want people doing. Who knows? I'm sorry.
Got some questions from the chat room. We love your email questions. We love your chat questions. You can email at Robert Heron, at Ryan Strout, at Patrick Norton. Obviously, we're very creative guys. Or email Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv. Fushigi. So it's 2 terabyte SSDs by 2014. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. The SSDs are scaling much faster than I expected them to. 1 terabyte, kind of almost getting common. So I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of 2014, 2 terabyte SSDs were common, if not particularly affordable. But yeah, that would be freaking awesome.
I would guess that that time frame too, maybe 40 or 50 cents a gigabyte or terabyte for that. Mm-hmm. Terabyte, gigabyte?
I'm not holding my breath on it getting that cheap. But at this point, if Alan's saying that he's hoping and praying that like 64 cents per gigabyte is going to hold on SSDs right now, I'd say a year out down to 42, that would be aggressive. But I have been wrong before and I will be wrong again. SIOK Online says, Robert, what headphones are you using?
These are the wonderful Plantronics Gamecom 780s. I picked them up a while back. I think they're about $80 online. They work pretty well. I guess they're like a 7-1 headphone if you want to use it for that, for games and stuff. But I find the mic works really well. They're relatively comfortable on my head. And I just needed something to replace. I had a previous pair of Plantronics that I was using, and I always liked the microphones on them. So I went with something a little more beefy this time around. And they're pretty good. Great cord, I must admit. USB-based, of course, like most of your stuff. But the cording on this particular set of headphones seems really well implemented in terms of how it connects to the headphones and its durability. So I picture I'll have these for years to come. But and they're pretty comfortable, I have to admit. As far as, you know, what they look like on there. And the switches on the back, too, for turning the microphone on off, as well as enabling or disabling the surround sound mode that's built into these as well. I think it is actually a full 7-1 headset. I haven't actually experimented with that, doing any listening tests regarding, you know, outside of gaming, of course. Right. But
Sounds good.
I like them a lot.
Robert Bigelow, Patrick and Robert Heron, is a constant temperature is that the ideal for cooling systems? I know that frequent changes in temperature decrease the functioning life of chipsets. Well, you can't really get a constant temperature. Ideally, yes, like a chip would operate at a single temperature over all time, but that doesn't really happen because you go from the computer being off or in idle or in standby or in you know, some sort of sub powered down mode. Then like you walk up, you touch the keyboard and it goes from, you know, 0 or 0.1% CPU up to 100% CPU as it launches Windows and transfers a bunch of data off the SSD to go from its suspend or hibernate mode. And then you run a bunch of web pages without flash, and you're running, you know, 10% of your processor, which is keeping barely above idle temperatures. And then suddenly you open an application like Photoshop or a video game and you're running 50 or 70% of your CPU and the heat goes up dramatically, or you decide to render out a video and suddenly you're using all 4 cores at 100% or all 6 cores at 100%. You know, ideally you keep the temperatures.
It's similar on the gaming side too with GPUs. Most games typically don't run at 100% GPU. However, if you're doing something like Bitcoin mining or you're running folding at home, those will stress the cards to as hard as they can within the thermal capabilities of the card itself before, you know, it'll run it up to, you know, almost 100% fan. And then at that point, the card will start backing itself off going, okay, this is the maximum workload I can handle with this temperature you're trying to throw at it. So that's the thing to keep in mind. It's fairly automatic in that. I tend not to worry about it. For me, it's more about, as far as desktop computers go, it's just the overall cooling package, making sure like I have to drag my system out, you know, twice a year minimum to go dust out the internals, to make sure especially the filters are cleaned out so that airflow can just get through it and that it's clean inside. And otherwise, it does a really remarkable job of taking care of itself, and I really don't worry about the temperature fluctuations all that much. And for notebooks, too, I would say it's even more critical to just it's harder to tell when a notebook gets dirty because it can look clean from the outside. But as we've seen, Patrick and I, we've broken open a notebook that looked fine from the outside, but it was just choked right around the fan, the bottom of the notebook seat where the fan and the cooler is. It was just choked full of stuff. And you wouldn't have even known that had you not taken it apart, at least the bottom part of the case off. So it's cooling is a bunch of parts put together, including its ability to monitor itself and then its ability to move the air through efficiently. And in the case of air coolers.
I mean, it's pretty funny when you look at it. I mean, quite frankly, I've had two dead motherboards in the last, I don't know, 8 years. One of them was dead on arrival. And when I looked up on Newegg, it turned out about 50% of the people who bought those motherboards seemed to have DOA problems with them. The other issue I had was involving water from a water cooling setup getting spilled onto the motherboard and releasing the magic smoke, which is hardly the fault of the motherboard. You know, if you were going from like, you know, negative 20 degrees to 150 degrees to negative 20 degrees to 150 degrees, I would be more worried about condensation than I would be about actual flexing of the PCB and the chips these days. That's just me. Like Robert said, they're super stable. They don't break very often. And, you know, your processor, you know, like the most efficient diesel engines run basically as close to one temperature as possible at one RPM, right? So that's how you get the absolute most amazing fuel efficiency out of a diesel engine, by basically finding the optimal. The peak of the torque curve is equal to the minimum of the fuel curve, and that's the most optimal place. And you want to keep it at the same temperature so the engine is most efficient. Chips aren't like that. Chips are designed for a TDP. They kind of have a power design sort of box that they live inside of. And as long as you have enough cooling to keep the chip inside of that, you're not going to have issues. They don't really wear out.
I would say that if you're constantly taking apart to its extreme, its limit, over and over and over, and then you're backing it down, that's all you're doing with it, sure, you're probably putting more stress on it compared to someone who's using it in a more traditional, just general usage. So that's something to keep in mind. But overall, as long as you got the cooling right and your airflow is decent and it's not choke full of dust, use the computers. Just use them and enjoy them.
Klaatu says, flash sucks up CPU and makes heat like crazy. There are some web-based players that are just evil. Absolutely. Actually, we just had another question on Techzilla we talked about this week. We're basically like, this is how you block flash. You can uninstall flash, but then you don't have it when you absolutely positively need it for some stupid website that still has a bunch of flash control modules or a video you want to watch. But we basically walked through on Techzilla this week how to block flash on IE and Firefox and Chrome, and even how to turn it off. Flash off completely inside of Chrome should you desire it. This is the most frightening question of the day. Caffeine free Dave. Okay, with my LG 47LE8500, I want to use a pair of headphones along with a Turtle Beach Earforce DSS2 Dolby surround sound processor to get simulated 5.1. bet this man has sleeping children or spouses somewhere. Turtle Beach says the optical output needs to pass DDL through. Does it pass DDL through the optical out? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it should for any source material you're listening to now. It sometimes is in the case of TV by TV. And I'll see if I can come up with a good chart that somebody's gone through all these sets. Some TVs I've come across will take devices that are inputting through HDMI into the TV and pass a Dolby Digital signal out the optical port. But that doesn't seem to be the case for a lot of TVs. It's usually just the apps that are built into the TV, as well, if they're providing a Dolby Digital out, as well as the TV's own digital tuner for over-the-air reception. If you're using either of those, the apps or that digital tuner, chances, and the programming that you're looking at is in Dolby Digital, it should be spitting that out over the optical output on the TV, provided that's how you have it set up in the settings. Most TVs, I think, will probably be set up to do PCM audio by default. Right. And you need to find a Dolby Digital track somewhere playing on a show or whatever, or use the either an app or the tuner, and then go ahead and make the change within the settings on the TV if it's from PCM to Dolby Digital if it's not already. But that setup should work, and it sounds like you got all the right hardware to do it. So good luck.
Surround sound without destroying the children or the spouse's happiness. This is a good thing.
You know, I like seeing Bluetooth built into TVs for this reason, too, because I know a lot of people have Bluetooth headsets or a Bluetooth pair of headphones. And even though it's not the most ideal way to listen to things, it sure is convenient. And it's really easy to set up or to pair your Bluetooth device with a TV or whatever else that supports Bluetooth. So that's one thing I like to see in newer TVs, too. But not every TV has Bluetooth built in. And so Not yet.
I like the. Now I just need to have. Yeah, the Roku 3 needs to add Dolby surround sound over headphones. Dolby headphone to the remote control. That would be crazy. HD Nation, what HDTV are you looking at this week, man?
Oh, I just got in the new Samsung F6400. It's about a $1,100 55-inch screen. It comes in a variety of sizes. This one's really neat in that it provides not only a thin bezel design, but also it's borderline on the value side of things, but it also provides your app experience in addition to their new touch remote, which is kind of cool. It's like a little touch pad that seems to work. It gets better with every generation, it seems. Good old Samsung keeps pushing this remote harder and harder, and it's actually getting to be quite the capable. And I'm just looking at it to see how it is in terms of black levels, how good and punchy the contrast is compared to some of the other TVs we've looked at recently from LG and Vizio and others, especially on the edge lit LED side of things. So we're plenty pleased, and we're always pushing the plasmas for their excellent black levels and performance in terms of viewing angles and other issues. But this would be good just to see. I know a lot of people are interested in LCDs out there, and this one's a good kind of middle in the road. It's not the least expensive model, but it's definitely not the most expensive one out there. And we'll have that set up for you. And I'll either be testing that tomorrow or Saturday. So we'll get that done and hopefully into the show next week if I'm prompt, which I should be.
One last one before we go. Eric Duckman. No, wrong one.
I will say quickly. Also, I am like on the verge of pushing buy on those Energy 5.1 speakers.
Really?
Just to get a set, because I have to get a set of speakers just ordered so I can use it for testing some AVR stuff. So if I do that,
deal.
And I'm definitely going to buy the AVR. So I got to do one. One will trigger the other. So
just get them both, man. Or get the AVR and then borrow some of the speakers we have in the lab. That'd be good. One more before we go. Duds Freed says, I'd like a water cooling setup for a desktop replacement gaming laptop. So would I. But it's not going to happen without making it yourself, probably carving a hole through the keyboard or removing the keyboard and then using an external keyboard, which kind of takes it from a desktop replacement gaming laptop to a desktop in a weird configuration you can't put a full-size graphics card into.
I've had more heating and cooling issues with notebooks than any other platform, especially when it comes to graphics chips. Like when I tried, I've got a decent graphics chip in my current notebook. But when I try to do certain gaming, man, that thing just wants to cook off. And that's definitely the hottest. The most I can cook my notebook is just full-on 3D gaming on it. And that, it's tough. And I don't know. I've never seen a water mod. I'm sure there's one out there, but I'm not looking for that. Again, make sure your cooling is dust-free. If you've had your notebook a while and you've never taken it apart, it might be worth just cracking open the bottom case to see if there's a giant dust bunny in there.
One last Knox looking to run his operating system off a USB 2.0 drive. It's like, will USB SSD be fast enough? No, it's not the drive, and it's not the drive being SSD or standard one. It's the little tiny USB, like somewhere. You don't have a lot of bandwidth on a USB 2.0 connection. USB 3.0, you might be able to do it. ESAT, definitely Thunderbolt. You know, I'd be thinking about it. But unless you are doing a live disk, like a Linux installation where it loads everything into main system memory and then ignores its storage, you are not going to have a lot of fun trying to run your operating system, your computer off of a USB 2.0 connection or through a USB 2.0 connection. And Web0139 says, what do you guys think of this bad boy? The Asus 15.6-inch touchscreen laptop, 6 gigabytes of memory, 750 gigabyte hard drive in black for $750. Looks lovely.
I was looking at a 13-inch Asus not too long ago, and basically their touchscreen version that had 1080p at 13 inches. And I was this close to buying that thing, but Patrick told me just to wait because it has well a few other chips at advancement.
So I took Patrick's advice,
but
I gotta say I would not buy any non Haswell laptop right now. Some of them are cheap, but Haswell is just unbelievably amazing.
And if you have a notebook made in the last three years and you haven't put an SSD in it yet, and if it doesn't already have one, that's the upgrade to go do. Because that will just make it feel like a brand new computer. Granted, you'll have to figure out, do an OS reinstall, make yourself happy. But that alone will help clean up any notebook. But not everyone is comfortable doing those types of reinstallations. Notebooks are definitely trickier than desktops. But still, it is the single finest upgrade you can do to your notebook. And I highly recommend jamming an SSD drive in there or swapping out the old drive for the new drive.
It is the, it's really like an amazing upgrade. By the way, the Asus 15.6-inch touchscreen, the i5-4200U, quote, is based on the Haswell architecture, manufactured in 22 nanometers, says notebookcheck.net. So $750 for Haswell, that should be awesome. I'm a little concerned that that page off of Best Buy says it's a two-cell polymer battery, so I want to make sure that that's either a typo or there are really, really big cells on that. Because two cell sounds a little low. And maybe that's a typo on that one. Where is the battery type polymer? Reader. I'll give you an extra $20 if you take it off. Wireless N, three USB 3.0 ports. Nice. Less than 5 pounds. Battery life not available. Uh-oh. Now I want to search out the battery life on this.
Just ignore that part.
Just ignore that part. Battery life is completely overrated.
See, I was going for the 3-pound notebook. I need a 3-pound notebook with that 13. Usually it's going to be a 13.3-inch screen roughly and then the 1080p resolution. That's what I really, really need. And then that's going to – but that would almost double the price compared to that particular notebook. A little bit bigger, suddenly the price drops or it becomes way more affordable, I find. That was that $750 or $550 for that notebook?
$750.
Yeah, that's a good price for the hardware that it has. An i5 and a notebook too.
I have to jump in really quick.
Quite a while.
So it also says software, Adobe Reader, and more.
we just ignore. We normally, you know, you're going to get the laptop home and you're going to wipe it out and reinstall Windows, right? I just ignore the bundled software. The only thing worse than like having them talk about Adobe Reader is talking about their free 60-day subscription to a virus, an antivirus that you hated. It's the antivirus just drives me nuts.
Give me that OS disk and let me just hit the format button and redo it all nice and clean. But then you got to figure out what drivers you need specifically, and that's the trick. Getting rid of all those little yellow triangles with the little exclamation point there in the device manager. But it's doable. Just got to figure it out. But then you get a nice end up with a super clean build on your notebook. And once you do it once, you'll have it down. It takes you minutes. It's literally nowadays, especially with Windows 8, it's like, what, a 10, 15-minute process to install the OS off of a USB drive?
Pretty much.
Finding those drivers. To get it all, so your function keys work and all your other special features for the notebook. That's the key. You don't want to ruin all those cool function buttons and stuff just by wiping out the original OS.
I can't find. Oh wait, 105? No, 501 LA. I can't find that laptop on Asus's webpage.
Which one?
The one we were just talking about. I can't find it. I want to find the battery life. I want to know the true battery size.
You know they're hiding it.
They heard I was coming and they hid it on the website.
They're gonna notice that. We have to legally put the two-cell battery down, though. We can't say. Just don't say how long it lasts. If it idles, what was it? We have to do an idle test just to see how long it would take to wipe it out just sitting at the Windows desktop.
Oh, my goodness. I can't find it. This is driving me mad. And with me going slightly mad in a search for non-existent laptop on the Asus website. That's a good sign that it's time to step away from the computer, ladies and gentlemen, and bid you adieu. It's not in there. Of course, they're not listing any of the Haswell-based processors on this webpage. No wonder I can't find it. That's it for this episode of Twitch. You can find me and Robert on Techzilla at techzilla.com, T-E-K-Z-I-L-L-A, or at HD Nation, revision3.com/HD Nation. And I want to thank everybody for hanging out with us. Yeah, Arbiter, I agree. It's probably a 6-cell battery, but why does it say 2-cell and why can't I find it on the Asus webpage? Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us. Mr. Robert Heron, will you have that review done by Tuesday, do you think?
If we need it done, I will go in tomorrow and Saturday and get that damn thing done. Actually, Saturday is the great open day in our studio, so it's the one time I will probably be in there. So, yeah, I'll get it done. It should be a good TV, and I'm looking forward. I'll get it set up tomorrow for sure, and I'll probably finish testing it on Saturday.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week.